Okay, should we get started? Let me first say that I have lots to say. I can keep talking for the next 2 hours really difficult. But I encourage you to interrupt me at any point if you have a question. And I'm trusting you to stop me if you'd like to. And I'd be glad to have this turn into something where there's more room for discussion. But until and unless I'm interrupted, I will continue to just try to provide us with material to talk about. I imagine as we go on, at some point in the next few weeks, hopefully you'll be interested in asking questions. Things today are going to begin to become complicated, as a glance at the board might already suggest. So what I'm going to really try to do today is start to give you an overview of some of the fundamental positions that I think really stake out the logical space of contemporary philosophy of perception. And my aim is to use Sellars as a backdrop for helping you see how that debate unfolds. I don't think this is the only way to do it. Well, we have to use Sellars, but I think it's a particularly good way to do that. So that's one of my aims. The second aim I have today is to prepare the discussion for next time. But what I want to discuss next time are the people I will call left-wing Sellarsians. And the left-wing Sellarsians, the three most influential ones, that are hundreds of them in my country, are Donald Davidson, who's now dead, and Richard Rorty, and perhaps most recently, and most influentially, Robert Brandom, and also perhaps I think most interestingly, I think he's articulated the shape such a view has to have and the kind of detail that the others have. So those are the three people we'll particularly be discussing next time. The handout I've passed around for today, towards the end of it, really moves into a discussion of the left-wing Sellarsians using Sellars as the basis for doing that. I don't actually imagine I'll be able to get through this whole handout today. That's fine. We'll just continue. We'll just stop as far as we get, and we'll continue on next time. The segue between what I want to do in the last part of today and what I want to do next time is fairly seamless. So that's a second thing I wanted to do today. The third thing I want to do is give you some sense of how contemporary philosophy of perception, in an interesting sense, can be seen to be sort of a battle over the soul of Sellars. This partly means that people are, various people, are claiming Sellars as their hero while having very different readings of them. But it also means that I think Sellars did a very good job of bringing out what the difficult issues are that are haunting contemporary philosophy of perception. And so that means that the way I'll be using Sellars today is mostly as an instrument for highlighting those problems. So what I'm not really going to talk about in this today or in the seminar, I just thought I'd come clean about this, is Sellars' solutions to these problems. Partly because that would be a lot of work. They're difficult and complicated. Partly because they have had virtually no influence. I think they mostly have not even been encountered, as I'll be indicating. I think everyone who claims Sellars here has actually misunderstood them. Part of the reason they had no influence is because they are so complicated. Where Sellars has had tremendous influence is in setting up the problems. It's really the first part of empiricism and philosophy of mind, as if that's the only part people have gotten through before they stop being completely exhausted by the difficulty of reading it, is the thing that's had tremendous influence. And then people have sort of, and it seems to me, mostly sort of assumed, well, this must be Sellars the solution, trying to look for some fairly quick way out of the problem as far as they've gotten a sense of it. Whereas Sellars himself, I think, has a sense of the problem as being deep enough that the solution is going to look quite complicated to him. But not to be completely frustrating and coquettish about this, I will at various points today, if you like, in the coming weeks, as we're discussing these issues, just point in the direction of where I take Sellars' own views to be, just so they make it clear there are such views and we could talk about them, and also to indicate why I think they have a kind of shape and structure that doesn't accord with what the commentators say. But I mostly won't be following out the direction that my pointing finger will be indicating in doing that. It's just to extend that there is, you know, an interesting subject there in its own right, namely Sellars' way of trying to solve these problems. But since my goal is really in the seminar to introduce you to sort of philosophy of perception in the 21st century, in a way giving you some of the solutions without would be part of that exercise, since those I think have essentially no influence not even no influence, no reception. We ended last time with the first thing on the handout, under number one, which was Sellers' inconsistent triad. My goal last time, which I just barely succeeded in attaining, was to get you to this point. So we had the point where we were encountering what I said was for Sellers the first guise in which he wishes us to encounter the myth of the giver in EPM, emphasizing that this by no means exhausts this conception of what is involved in the myth. But it's a particularly fragrant, and the time he was writing in the middle of the last century, influential form of the myth, namely what he calls classical sense data theory. And the inconsistent triad is posing a problem for the classical sense data theorists. It's meant to bring out a certain difficulty in one's account of perception. The classical sense data theorist is someone who wants to say all of A, B, C under number one. He wants to both say that sensing red sense contents already puts one in a position to have a certain kind of awareness of knowledge. So I sense a red sense content. I'm in a position to say something like, that is red. I have some kind of minimal knowledge. And that's crucial to the classical sense theory view, because whatever happens at this first stage is supposed to be a ground floor for justifying the rest of knowledge. So it's something that looks like it needs to have the shape of knowledge itself, basic, fundamental knowledge, in order for it to justify other elements of knowledge. As we said, there's many classical sense data theorists actually think that sensing a red sense content simply is a case of non-inferentially knowing that's red. Sellers has weakened this here to entails to cover any version of the sense of classical sense data theorists, including someone who's more careful about that. They also want to say that what it is to sense something is an unacquired ability. We sense things in virtue of the kind of sensible constitution we have. Different from chimpanzees, but much the same as our prelinguistic children. We open our eyes, open our ears, and, as the person might say, information comes in. So the idea of sensing itself is merely an exercise of our natural capacities, assuming they're not deformed in some way, that we're not deafblind, colorblind, whatever. And thirdly, it's a feature of classical empiricism that Sellers thinks is a wise one, to notice that most of our concepts for things seem to involve choices about how to carve up a spectrum of kinds in a way that rests on conventions. How you carve up the color spectrum, how you carve up the words you use for denoting kinds of furniture, and so forth, don't seem to be a matter of just reading off how things are, but first having kinds that you bring to your description of things. In German, there's a word for Stuhl, and a word for Sessel. In English, we just have the word for chair. If you go into the right kind of living room and you ask how many, using these different concepts, you're going to get a different answer, because the concepts carve things up slightly differently. In French, you have a rive and fleuve. In English, you just have a river. You look at a map, you count differently, depending upon which concept you're bringing to bear. So this involves the idea that the ability to know facts of the form, as I put it here, you see, X is phi, X falls under this concept, depends on first mastering the concept. And mastery of the concept is an acquired ability. Yes?
Well, that's one question concerning the use of acquire and,
yes,
and unacquire.
Yes.
Can we take for granted that there is not, there are not two kinds of acquirings, that it's not only concepts which are acquired, but well, there might be a kind of perceptual training.
Sure.
Not conceptual, but still, which has some kind of cognitive content.
Yes. Well, if you were here last time, I talked about Lewis's view, And Lewis very much has a view like that. But and we'll come back to that view in a moment. But right now, all we're doing is setting up a problem for the classical sense data theorist, who doesn't have that kind of view. Lewis is actually not a classical. And for him, the classical sense data theorist, this is enough to generate a problem. He doesn't have such a distinction. He wants concepts to be acquired, but he wants to hold A while holding B, that the sensing of sense contents is unacquired. And we could, you could say to him, without more distinctions, you have a problem, which is indeed very much what Lewis says. We can come back to Lewis's view in a moment. So this is not an argument that shows anything yet. This is merely an ad hominem problem for the classical sense data theorist. It's not an argument to a conclusion. It's just an inconsistent trial. And then very much the question is, where should you go from here? And actually, we just had a suggestion about one way to go, which we'll come back to. But what I want to do right now is, rather than plunge in one direction, sort of lay out the shape of this crossroad so we can see how different views, including Lewis's, come off it. So in two, we have just a kind of spelling out of how this constitutes a trilemma for the classical sense data theorist. He can abandon A, but then, although he might be able to hold on to the idea that sensing sense contents is somehow a condition, maybe a logically necessary condition, of being able to non-inferentially know things, being able to look and see and thereby know things, he's not going to be able to have sensing play the kind of foundational role he wants. So it will not constitute knowledge anymore. Or he can abandon B. I think, well, sensing itself is somehow an acquired ability. But initially, the idea was to put things like sensing in a box with feeling pain, having afterimages, tickles, itches, just to have it be part of our sensory constitution. So clearly a kind of work is required to give up B that he hasn't done. I think, as was just being suggested, we'll see that somebody like Lewis is sort of interested in not exactly abandoning B, but introducing complexity at this point in the view. Or he could try to abandon C. But C would be, Sellars thinks, to cease to be an empiricist altogether. It would give up on the idea that ideas themselves have to be forged. They can't simply be read off the world. Now, Sellars himself offers his own diagnosis of what goes wrong here. What Sellars wants to say is, and he has various diagnoses, but the first diagnosis he wants to say, offer, is one in which he wants to say the very idea of the sensing of a sense content is, as he puts it, a mongrel idea that results from the crossbreeding of two perfectly good ideas. Mongrel idea here might suggest a kind of idea. But I take it Sellars' point is actually the classical concept of sensing isn't a coherent idea. It's kind of a wavering or a conflation of two different ideas, each of which are perfectly good. Sort of imagining you have one idea sort of hovering between the two without actually having articulated a concept of a sense data. So just looking at this picture for a moment, just looking at certain features of the picture without all, I borrow this diagram from Grandin. The idea of classical sense data theorist is supposed to be, we have physical objects, and I will just put this very vaguely for the moment, using the word because each time I come to one of these arrows. And because we have those, or because we interact with those, or however you want to put this, that gives rise to the sensing of sense contents. And because we have those, because we enjoy sense contents, that allows us to, or puts us in position to, or leads us to, have non-inferential beliefs, like such and such is red. And because we have those, that puts us in a position to, or leads us to, be able to arrive at other inferential beliefs. Like, for instance, things like there's at least one red thing in the universe. Richard's claim that there are no red things is false, or whatever thing we want to go on and claim, in which that plays a role. So we have these becauses. And the question is, how should we understand this because? This because is supposed to have what Sellars calls a physical ground. It's one of, as it were, mere causation. And if our natural science of physiology reaches the state that physics is presently in, maybe we can even formulate a kind of noethic generalization we don't presently have about exactly what objects give rise to which sense impressions. But the project of explaining this is one of bringing things under relations of merely efficient causation. This relationship, too, he thinks is fairly perspicuous, though importantly not to be confused with this. This has what he calls an epistemic grammar. I'll come back to that word in a few minutes. Can't explain everything at once. But the idea is that these beliefs stand to those beliefs in the kind of relations that beliefs stand to each other. These are relations between beliefs, where one can justify another, one can be a premise for conclusion, one can entail the other, and so forth. They stand in various kinds of logical and conceptual relations, not merely physical relations. I'll come back to that too. This is sometimes what people like Brandom or summarizes as the space of causes and the space of reasons, echoing this part of Sellars. McDowell doesn't like talking that way for various reasons, so he'll call this the realm of law, or the realm of nomothetic intelligibility, and the space of reasons. He doesn't mind the second phrase, which is also Sellars. Sellars himself actually speaks here of these things having different grammars, of this having a physical grammar, this having an epistemic grammar. Come back to all of that. But the question is, how do we understand the relations between the sensing of sense contents and non-inferential beliefs? And Sellars wants to say, in quotation 3 on your handout, that this idea of sensing sense contents actually involves a hybrid of two different ideas. One is something which is just the product of this physical interaction, something you could have or a little child could have, or whatever. It's the idea number one at the top of 2, that there's certain inner episodes which could occur to human beings or brutes, and they could enjoy these episodes without any prior process of learning or concept formation. And maybe even they need to enjoy these episodes in order to be able to do the thing which is the subject of 2. 2 is the idea that there are certain inner episodes which are themselves non-inferential knowings, that aren't just episodes of hearing right, but are episodes in which the person who hears red, if you will, is aware, I'm sorry, hears C sharp or sees red, is aware that they are seeing red, such that their awareness of something's being red could serve as a premise for a conclusion. Such as a conclusion, for instance, like there is a red thing. And he wants to say those two things, merely having a certain sensory episode take place in one, and being able to experience one's sensory episode as a case of such and such. Those aren't the same thing. And those two things have been run together. Come back to this. That's his initial diagnosis of the problem. But now, just in terms of setting up contemporary philosophy of perception, what I want to say is, once we see that, once we see there's a problem here, and we want to take this apart, what do we do? How do you want to take it apart? What do you want to do? It's here that the paths to the different views that are currently warring with each other, I think, come. That's the sense in which I think Sellars gives us a useful point of departure. A few other comments just to avoid forms of confusion that may come with next week if I don't make some remarks now. One of our protagonists in the seminar is Brandom. Brandom explains his own views in the guise of explaining Sellars' views. If you learn your Sellars from Brandom, I think what you're mostly learning is Brandom, though being told that it's Sellars. I think there's this problem with McDowell's relation to Sellars, too, but not near as spectacularly text-free in the character of the interpretation as it is in Brandom's case. So what you get in quotation 4 is a quotation from Brandom's study guide, in which Brandom just tells you what the myth of the given is. That is, Brandom identifies the myth of the given with a certain idea. And what I think is right is that if you only read to the end of section 1, part 1, of Empiricism and Philosophy of Mind, that is, if you read 1/16th of the essay and you stop, and you ask yourself, what is the myth of the given? Then I think what Brandom says is quite reasonable. But Brandom suggests that For the purposes of reading the whole essay, we've learned everything we need to know about the myth at this point, and we can now, as it were, define it. So he says, quotation 4 on your handout, the myth of the given is that the idea that it can be a kind of awareness that has two properties. First, it is or entails having a certain sort of knowledge, perhaps not of other things, but at least that one is in that state or a state of that kind, that one is having experience of red or C-sharp. And knowledge that the one whose state is possesses it simply in virtue of being in that state. Second, it entails the capacity to have that sort of awareness, that this capacity does not presuppose the acquisition of any concepts. So to put this a little more complicated, simply in virtue of sensing something, you can know something. And whatever fact you know, however you want to describe it, is the kind of fact that can come into view for you without having learned anything, and in particular without having acquired concepts. Those particular things you need to learn. Now, one way of already starting to wonder whether Branham's gloss on the myth of the given is going to serve as a gloss for the whole of EPM is to remember Lewis's views that we talked about last time. What we saw about Lewis is that he's very concerned to claim that merely sensing something, or mere episodes of the given, cannot amount to knowledge. We must have concepts as well. Indeed, every experience, remember these metaphors, is an interwoven unity of conceptualization and the given. So, Lewis will agree with this quotation. He'll read it and think, exactly. If somebody holds that view, that merely enjoying an episode of the given could give you knowledge without concepts, then they have a mythical conception of the given. Lewis could agree with that. But Lewis has generally been held to be, and even Branham would agree with this, so I don't think he's ever read Lewis carefully, one of Sellars' main targets. So Lewis's conception of the given that we get in chapter 2 of Mind and the World Order that we talked about last week is supposed to be a target. If it itself is supposed to come under the rubric of the myth of the given, if it itself is supposed to be a guise of the myth of the given, there better be more to the myth than what Branham says here. So I do think what Branham says here is right if we're just summarizing what we've seen from the inconsistent triumph, the end of part one. But if Lewis is supposed to come in the target range, and we'll see later today, I hope at the beginning next time how he does, then this first guise, it better just be the very beginning of a more extended treatment of the topic on Lewis's part. But because Branham wants to draw what I think by Sellars' lights is a very premature moral from part one, he's not really concerned with such niceties as whether there might be other guises of the myth. Next thing I asked you to think about for today, which also just point out, is that the next thing, Branham, this is also really mostly to prepare what we're going to do in 2 weeks from now, but just to have you thinking about things as you're doing the reading. It's worth noticing the next sentence in Branham's study guide. After Branham says this about Sellars and what the myth is for the Sellars, he says, as McDowell puts the point, and he quotes McDowell. So, surely the rhetoric of Branham here is, there's something Branham, McDowell, and Sellars all agree on. Namely, what the given is, what the myth of the given is, whether one wants such a thing, and how one should characterize it. And one of the things I'll be suggesting is that by none of those points is there agreement between these three thinkers. And it's itself a misrepresentation on Branham's part, and a failure on his part to encounter the views of someone with whom he was a colleague for 11 years from 1976 to 87, namely Sellars, and someone who he's been a colleague with for almost 20 years, 87 to 2006, namely McDowell. So Branham is determined to view everyone through the lens of his own views. This is how McDowell puts the point. This is presented by Branham. I think Branham thinks this is just another way of saying the same thing. Quote, the idea of the given is the idea of the space of reasons, the space of justifications or warrants. The idea that that space extends more widely than the conceptual sphere. With respect to Branham's account of the myth of the given, if we take Lewis's view that we looked at last time, Lewis will read quotation four and go, yeah, that's a really bad idea. The idea that mere episodes of the given can constitute knowns. With respect to the thing that McDowell says in quotation five, Lewis will say, no, that's right. That is what the idea of the given is. The idea of the given, for Lewis, is the idea that the space of justifications or warrants, or as he prefers to say, that which can guide the application of concepts, must extend more widely in the conceptual sphere. The given and the pure concept do not limit one another, and they must be taken to be fundamentally independent of each other. And if not, all our knowledge would be contentless and arbitrary. Remember Lewis saying that last time? Should have brought your handout from last time, too. So, one way of seeing very quickly that that Branham's gloss on what he claims is all that the myth of the given is for Sellars, and his equating with that, with McDowell's gloss on the myth of the given, that those two glosses come to the same thing. One way of seeing that they do not come to the same thing is simply to introduce the views of Lewis, who we looked at last time, and notice that Lewis will reject the first idea of the given for exactly the same reasons that Branham and Sellars does, and he will want to hold on to the second idea of the given. It's absolutely essential to vindicating the credentials of knowledge. Another question also, which we will come to, is how Sellars himself stands with respect to McDowell's philosophy of the given. This is not a quotation from Sellars in any sense. Would he think that idea of the given is a problematic one? Come back to that question. So, we have this chart here. Physical grammar is the relationship between physical objects and the sensing of sense contents. And epistemic grammar is the kind, characterizes the kind of relationship that beliefs stand into, to other beliefs, including non-inferential beliefs and inferential beliefs. Then what about this relationship? Sensing of sense contents and non-inferential beliefs. What kind of because mediates the connection between these two moments in our chart? The myth of the given said, the one just sort of entails the other, or it is the other. And the criticism there was that was a conflation of two grammars based on a hybrid conception of two notions of sense content. There's no clear idea here at all. There's a mythical idea of something that's both a cause and a mere cause and a reason at the same time. And the question is, what do we do about this? As we'll see in more detail, mostly next week, but towards the end of this week as well, what the left-wing Sellarsians, Davidson, Broidy, especially Branham for the purpose of our seminar, says, what Sellars has shown us, and then confusingly, Rorty and Branham also say, and what Sellars himself concluded, is that it's a mistake to look for an arrow here. There's the realm of causes, there's the space of reasons. These things do not connect. Rather, as Branham puts it kind of helpfully in the title of his article that we're reading for next week, Sellars has a two-ply conception of knowledge. There's this plank and there's this plank, and you sort of stand on both of them together and you get knowledge, but it's a mistake to look for a connection here immediately across a transept positioned in this way. Say more about that in a moment. Mostly what I want to bring out right now is if you read even to the end of part one of EPM, you immediately have reasons to worry about this reading of Sellars. Because even before you get to the end of part one, you get a quotation like six on your handout, which is just mostly a programmatic remark. It's not yet the explanation of the view. But it's already a programmatic remark that's telling you that something's coming. It sure looks like it's missing on this reading of Sellars. Sellars says, there's no reason to suppose that having the sensation of a red triangle is a cognitive or epistemic fact. So something that Sellars wants to call the sensation of a red triangle, that's more than the sensing of a sense content. as the of there suggests. It's sensations of red triangles stand in some kind of relation to objects. It's not known as merely mere causation of things. But at the same time, there's reasons to think it's not over here either. There is, of course, a temptation to assimilate having a sensation of a red triangle to something like thinking of a celestial city, something that does have a straightforward intentional content, and to attribute the former, the epistemic character, the intentionality of the latter. But this temptation could be resisted, and if we read on to the end of EPM and other of Sellers' works, we'll find out his view is it should be resisted, and it could be held, and we'll see later, or we would see if we read on, that it should be held, that having a sensation of a red triangle is a fact sui generis, neither epistemic nor physical, having its own logical grammar. So very quickly, this is just programmatic, but Sellers' view is nothing like this form, but rather he suggests that we need an understanding of the case of what sensations are. It sees how sensations stand to what they are sensations of, an understanding of that relationship, that neither assimilates it to the case of efficient causation, nor to the case of one thing's being a reason for another. But that you have a different kind of relationship there, that it has a different grammar, it needs to be characterized in different terms. That's a programmatic remark for a very large project itself. If you look over here, just very quickly, you also see there isn't just one arrow here, but there's three more arrows. So having a sensation of something is just part of a much more complicated story. Because if you just had one arrow, then you would fall back into the myth of the given, Sellers thinks. So understanding the sui generis character of sensations is only part of a larger project. But that, again, is just one of those moments of finger pointing that I promised to tantalize you with. Just a remark here now on Sellers' terminology. This connects back to some of my quick remarks last week about the difference between a Cartesian and a Kantian problematic in the philosophy of perception. One way to see that Sellers' concern with the Kantian problematic is to notice, if you will, the Kantian use of the term epistemic here. Epistemic here does not mean cases in which, you know, you have true beliefs. Epistemic here means cases in which you have deliverances, be they experiences, thoughts, whatever, that can so much as be true or false. So one Sellers is the example here of what we don't want to assimilate the sensation of our triangle to, is thinking of the celestial city, thinking of the city of Atlantis, something that did not exist. But our thought of the celestial city still is intentionally articulated. I can think of the celestial city and conclude there was no such city. That conclusion, there was no such city, being able to form that kind of belief about it, requires that it have an epistemic grammar. So epistemic grammar here means the kinds of things that articulate in such a way that they can be true or false. So one can misread Sellers just as easily as one can misread Kant if one doesn't realize the language, the problematic is shifted here. Epistemic grammar does not mean yet the question of how you tell which of these are true and false. It's just the kind of relation that these sorts of beliefs can so much as stand in, so they can be candidates for truth and falsity. Okay. Now, this is a way of seeing that this is the way Sellers talks, I've skipped way ahead in EPM for a moment just to give you a sense of his lingo. He says, the essential point is that in characterizing an episode or a state as that of knowing, we are not giving an empirical description of that episode or state. I think that can be slightly misconfusing when he says there. But what he means is we're not describing it as a mere empirical event that can be studied by the physical sciences. We're not characterizing it as something that merely transpires as an episode in nature. We are placing in the logical space of reasons, of justifying and being able to justify what one says. That is, in characterize something as a state of knowing, whether it turns out to be genuinely a case of knowing or not, In so characterizing it, we're placing it in this kind of space. And that quotation of Sellars is an incredibly famous quotation in the sense that this phrase, the space of reasons, is now the name of conferences and books and articles, and it's kind of flowered all over the place. But it's his attempt to characterize what a few used as other label for it, the idea that beliefs stand with respect to each other in a way that has to be characterized by a grammar that's distinct from the way in which objects that really cause each other stand in. And he thinks we need yet another category before we're going to have a good starting philosophy of perception. That's the feature, one of the features of this view, one of many, that escapes the Neo-Sellars. So now we've come to the diagram, which I've already been looking at. So this is the diagram as Brandon draws it in the study guide, I think pretty closely at least, with this sort of question mark. Brandon asks us to ask the question, okay, new, this relationship between sense contents and non-inferential beliefs, is it physical or is it epistemic? Which is it? Which is it? Come on. And the thought is, if you're Brandon, you're not going to want to say this, you're not going to say one, you're not going to say three, and the conclusion you should draw is, it's neither, because it's nothing. There is no room for relation here. That's how, and you can see how this is faithful to Sellars up to a point. But then this conclusion is forced that leads to this bar here, and a very different kind of a view. A very bizarre kind of view, I think, which interestingly is, I think, as close to being the mainstream view in contemporary American philosophy perception, or Anglo-American philosophy perception, as any. And that's a testament to how deeply Sellars succeeded in impressing people about this problem, while failing to impress people at all with his solution. So that you lead to this absolute terror of getting close to the problem. So you can think of this as sort of building the fence 300 feet from the cliff. You know you're not going to fall off the cliff if you don't get near it. And so let's just not talk about this relationship, and we won't get in any trouble. Now we need to find a way to set up a view in which we don't even try to move in this direction. Well, as I say, that will be our topic next week. Just very quickly, just so that we have some sort of overview, we can come back to the details of this in the coming weeks, but using Brandon's diagram and bringing out the way in which it will not suffice to account for all of the things that Brandon pretends it accounts for. Brandon's suggestion is, these are the two choices. So the people that believe in the given, and Brandon's suggestion is that includes the classical sensitive theorists, who have this mythical conception of the given. But he also suggests, and that includes Lewis, because anyone who believes in the given must have this problem. And suggests, no one else suggests that's wrong. And then these are the people that don't believe in the mythical conception of the given. Those people don't believe in any conception of given. As Brandon says, experience is not one of my words. Paraphrasing Oscar Wilde in his trial, he says, oh, sir, blasphemy is not one of my words. So Brandon says, experience is not one of my words. And he will tell you proudly, that if you look in the index to his enormous book, Making It Explicit, although every philosophical term of art there is just about occurs in that index, the word experience does not occur once in the book, showing that we do not need such a concept. That's the alternative. And since Sellars is his hero, he assumes that Sellars must go with these guys. So what I'm trying to bring out very quickly with green and red here is, here are two options that are not exhausted in what Brandon represents, not only as a forced choice, but the forced choice that Sellars is attempting to help us make. There's Lewis's view that we discussed last time. Lewis very much agrees you can't get straight from here to here. So Lewis thinks what you got to do is move more slowly, not digging your heels at this point. So we saw that Lewis tried to introduce the notion of qualia. Qualia are themselves universal. The sensing of any sense content is a particular, unique historical event, as he says. But across such cases, across time, we are able to recognize particular sense presentations, particular sense contents, as qualitatively the same. Lewis wants to say we have this capacity. This is now connected, I think, with the suggestion that was made by Professor Brown at the beginning. That is an ability he thinks we have, which is an unacquired ability, but it's not the unacquired ability in any sense. But that ability itself can be refined over time, the bare ability, so that we acquire the capacity to recognize this content as the same as that one. Which is both an unacquired and acquired capacity here. Those quality in turn guide the application of concepts. What is for something to be an instance of a quail is not the same thing as for it to be an instance of a concept. And if we weren't able, in some sense, through the exercise of our capacities of sense, to recognize this and this and this and this as the same color, we wouldn't be able to apply the concept right. So it's our ability to do this that guides and grounds our belief that they are all blue, which is not to be identified with that, and which then allows us to form beliefs like this is blue, here are four blue things, and we're off in the position to form further inferential beliefs. Like blue chairs seem to be popular at this university, or blue jeans seem to be the pants of choice, and so forth. So Lewis, if he's got a problem, isn't it that he just conflates these two things? He doesn't just have the mongrel idea of the sense datum, where he conflates two things. He does not identify the sensing of sense contents with this, and he introduces something else which is neither. So the diagnosis of what goes wrong at the end of part one with the inconsistent triad does not affect Lewis. Lewis would agree with that diagnosis and is taking a different turn. So if we're going to get a criticism of Lewis, more needs to be said about the given. But I take it Sellars, in going on in incredible detail for many more pages to continue to refine his characterization of the given, is after developing the resources to also criticize a position like this and say, a position like this doesn't really solve this problem. It sees the shape of the problem, but it's not getting around in a successful way. But also notice, just from what I put here, that Sellars' own sense of a solution shares something with Lewis. That is, he continues to think that you need some kind of guidance or some kind of normative constraint that is not merely inferential constraint on our beliefs about the world if we want to avoid what I called last week vicious idealism. We want to avoid the problem of our beliefs being contentless and arbitrary. So, in a very general way, there's something that Sellars is taking from Lewis, but he thinks what it is to solve the problem is extremely difficult, because he thinks what it is to avoid the myth is extremely difficult. That's, again, just very prospective. We'll come back to the details, but I think it's helpful occasionally to take the helicopter up a few feet, see how, some sense of the larger forest before you go down. Let's go back and look at some trees in this forest. So let's go back to Brandon now. I'm going to do this one. Maybe it's a good moment to take a break. So I start talking about Brandon. Maybe. So should we come back and look at 5 seconds?